Thank you so much for coming out on a wonderful rainy evening. I understand it's been a long fall for Montana. And I'm grateful to God for bringing moisture.
Amen.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. Any bird watchers know what kind of bird this is? Called a hoopoe. The hoopoe bird is well known in Saudi Arabia, where I grew up, and so we used to see these in our yard all the time. There's a fascinating story in the Quran about the hoopoe bird. Solomon, according to the Quran, was able to speak the languages of the animals and of the jinn, what we would in English call the genies, and he enlisted them all into his overall army. One day he got all his conscripts together and noticed that the hoopoe bird was missing. And he was pretty ticked off because no animal or human or genie was supposed to disregard the king's commands. So Solomon asked where the hoopoe is, and other creatures answered that it was out and about. Solomon was getting ready to punish the hoopoe when he returned. But the hoopoe said, "I've been flying around areas that you've never been to, Solomon, and I came across a land with a people that is ruled by a woman, and she has quite an army and also a lot of wealth." And Solomon, of course, was interested in that, and that's how he became acquainted with the Queen of Sheba. In Arabic, it's Saba, and that's considered generally to be the land of modern-day Yemen. That's just a little aside, and I'm going to do that talk tonight. This individual, you may have heard of last August, a year ago August, that is, he was arrested in London as he was trying to board a plane to Istanbul. On his way, he wanted to fight for ISIS. About 33 years old, was 31 at the time. Native Ugandan, but had become a British citizen, converted to Islam, and he decided that his goal in life, what Allah was calling him, as well as all Muslims to do, was to go and fight with ISIS against the non-Muslim world, and to live a life as a combatant, a jihadi, and to take part in all that that Islam afforded the jihadis. So he was captured. He had kept a diary on his phone, and so the authorities were able to discern his motivations from his diary. He wanted to fight for ISIS. He wanted to buy and marry up to four women from the slave market, the ISIS slave market, with highest priority being given to a 9-year-old virgin girl. He was, when he was captured, he had 3,000 British pounds on him, which he was going to carry out his dreams. His diary said, "If I ever marry again, it's got to be a virgin 9 years old, is what I would want. The younger and experienced," I think he meant inexperienced, "the better." In the meantime, he said, he had been seeding some women over here, UK white. You can see in these statements a complete disregard for women as human beings, and also an utter contempt for British, that is, for non-Muslim white women. He saw them as just something to be able to use for his own pleasure. He spoke as well of his dream to own slaves and the permissibility of slavery in Islam when he was testifying in British court. "In our religion," he said, "in Islam, it's okay to have slaves. The Prophet had slaves, so I'm talking, if I ever possess slaves, I'm saying slaves is connected to the religion. It's an integral part of our religion." Now, that statement that he made that I just read was in defense of his written diary entry that the authorities had discovered, which was this: "If I ever possess slaves, I won't free them, except maybe on my deathbed, peace be upon Allah. Pisabilalas and Arabic phrase found in the Quran many times, it means according to or in the way of Allah. Jihad is often spoken of in the Quran with this phrase after it, doing jihad fi sabilillah, for the sake of Allah or in Allah's cause. With priority given, as I may free them, with priority given to those who become Muslim first. So what we want to talk about in this first session, about 40 minutes to cram an hour's worth in, nature, human nature, dignity, and value in Islam, supremacy and subordination. Those are the poles around which human nature revolves according to Islam. The Quran teaches that human beings are created in a variety of ways. Adam was created, the Quran says, from the dust of the earth, or from clay, or molded mud, or from wet earth, or from gushing fluid, which is a reference most likely to semen, or from a drop, that is a drop of sperm, or a combination of all of those, which you can find in the Quran, chapter 22, verse 5. Don't take time to read that. The Quran also said that Allah breathed His spirit into Adam to give him life and unique abilities. Eve was then created from the nafs, the Arabic word for soul or spirit, life, force of Adam, according to the Quran. The Hadith traditions, let me just pause there in case you're not aware, Islam has three major revelatory sources by which it brings together teachings that ultimately distill into Sharia law. Sharia law is the skeletal framework of Islam's understanding of how human beings are to relate to Allah and how they're to relate to the world around them. Those three sources are the Quran itself, Hadith literature, which are reports that have been passed on from generations about how Muhammad lived his life, or when he was asked a question by someone, what answer he gave. So the Hadith is this voluminous collection, six volumes, six different collections of various volumes, that Muslims appeal to in order to understand the life of Muhammad and how they themselves are then to try to model themselves after Muhammad. So according to this one Hadith tradition, Muhammad is reported to have said, whoever believes in Allah in the last day should not hurt or trouble his neighbor. And I advise you to take care of the women, for they are created from a rib, and from the most crooked portion of the rib, its upper part. If you try to straighten it, it will break. If you leave it, it will remain crooked. So I urge you to take care of the women. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that means. And when I first read that, not too long ago, I wondered if maybe President Trump has read that and was thinking about Hillary Clinton. And Hillary, I think probably not. However, this indicates a borrowing from Jewish tradition about Eve being taken from a crooked portion of the rib of Adam and then being built into a human being from that beginning. One big thing to understand about it, Muslim perception of human nature as opposed to Christian perception and Jewish perception also, is that in Islam, human beings are not recognized as having been created in the image and likeness of God. But rather, they are created to be the slaves of Allah. I'm going to read this. This is just one long passage from the Quran that talks about how Adam was given priority over all the angels. And the way Allah did that is that Allah himself knew the names of all of the animals he created, but he never revealed those names to the angels. He does reveal those names to Adam. And then he goes to the angels and says to them, tell me the names of all the animals. They say, well, we don't know the names. And then Allah brings Adam in front of the angels and says to Adam, tell me the names of all the animals. And of course, Adam now knows them because Allah revealed them to him. So Allah has the angels bow before Adam, because Adam has been designated as the one who will serve as Allah's representative over the earth. All of the angels bow before Adam, except one creature. His name is Iblis. Iblis is a devil. He is the devil, is the shaitan among many demons, and he is castigated, ultimately thrown out of heaven because he refuses to bow before Adam. Now this is interesting theologically, because the Quran and Islam teach that people are not to bow before anyone or anything except Allah. So one can make the case that Iblis, the devil, was actually following Allah's commands not to bow before anything except Allah himself. But in Islamic theology, Iblis or Satan or Shaitan, Arabic word for Satan, is seen as the one who is so puffed up with pride in himself that he is not willing to bow before a human being. And so because of his pride, he's cast out of heaven. Satan falls as a result of his refusal to bow, and that before he is kicked out of heaven, he declares that it's his intention to mislead as many human beings as possible from obedience to Allah. While he's still in paradise, he tempts Adam and his wife, who together forget their covenant with Allah and so disobey. But as a result of their disobedience, they confess to Allah. He brushes their sins aside and gives them fresh guidance as to how they are to live. And so Islam teaches today that human beings, if they follow the guidance that Allah has given through the Quran, should be safe from His wrath. I say should be because Allah can do whatever He wants, and no one can demand anything of Him, so that He can decide whether He's going to keep His word in a particular case or not. This is another passage in Surah 20 that says basically the same thing, repeats the story and concludes. So surely, so this is Allah speaking to Adam and Eve, there will come to you guidance from me, and whoever follows my guidance, he shall not go astray nor be unhappy. Interestingly, in Islam, the sin of Adam and his wife did not lead to a fallen nature, but rather to forgiveness and a fresh start. They have the same nature that they were originally created with. It's a nature that ultimately Islam teaches is good, but is weak and prone to error. So Quran says, Surah 30, verse 30, therefore you shall devote yourself to the religion of strict monotheism, that is Islam. Such is the natural instinct placed into the people by God. Such creation of God will never change. This is the perfect religion that most people do not know. So that passage is saying that human beings are created with a good nature, and that sin did not corrupt human nature. In contrast to that, as Christians, we believe that human beings indeed were created good, no evil, in how God created human beings, but evil is introduced mysteriously into God's good creation order, and human beings, when they gave into that evil, when they fell prey to temptation and sin, our human nature was forever changed. It became corrupted. We talked about man's fallen condition. And that is something that human beings cannot dig their way out of. We can't undo that fallenness. We have to be rescued. We have to be saved. In Islam, there is no salvation. There's no need for salvation because human nature never got corrupted. So for Muslims, life in this world is a test to see if human beings will obey their natural goodness or whether they'll go astray. However, on the other hand, the Quran also declares that human beings are by nature ungrateful, foolish, weak, despairing, proud, adversarial, that is towards Allah, rebellious. And according to this blockbuster passage, in my opinion, chapter 16, Surah 16, verse 61. If Allah punished the people for their transgressions, He would have annihilated every creature on earth. Now, it's hard to see how human nature could be given as good, and yet every human being stands under the potential decree of God's wrath for sin. How do we reconcile these with the notion that human nature is good and weak? Well, Islam doesn't attempt to reconcile those. Instead, it looks at people whom Allah favors over against those whom Allah despises. So all human beings share the nature of Adam, but apparently not all are of equal worth and dignity in the eyes of Allah. Islam makes a great and absolute division within human race between those who deserve all the advantages that Allah promises and those who are to be taken advantage of at our commands. So in the Islamic hierarchy of humanity with regard to dignity and value, Muslim men are those who are of greatest value because they are both believers and the heads of families, of tribes. After that come Muslim women who are believers, and then after them come the dignity, I'll define that term in a little bit, and then after them slaves, then next the kuffar, talk about what that means, and lastly those who are apostates in Islam. Let's talk about women in Islam. Muslim women are subject to their husbands, or if they're not yet married, to their fathers, or if their fathers have passed away, to the eldest brother of the family. Why are they subject to male authority over them? Because, as the Quran says, they are inferior to men. Men are in charge of women because Allah has made the one of them to excel the other, and because they spend of their property for the support of women. So good women are the obedient, guarding in secret that which Allah has guarded, that is, guarding their private parts, and as for those from whom he, this is speaking to men now, among those whom ye fear rebellion, your wives, admonish them, banish them to their beds apart, and scourge them. Most Muslim scholars believe this is sort of an ascending scale of punishment. If you notice, it's not even if they are disobedient to you, but if you fear that they are going to be disobedient, start by admonishing them. If they don't shape up, then banish them from your bed, from a separate room. If that doesn't get their attention, then scourge them or beat them. Is a literal translation of this Quranic passage. Then if they obey you, seek not a way against them. So once they fall into line, then you can treat them nicely again. The Quran says women have such honorable rights as obligations, that is, they have the right, if you marry them, that they should have a roof over their heads, and they should have food to eat and clothes to wear. Because those are women's basic rights as wives. But the men have a degree above them, and if they have more rights than the wives do. Additionally, in Islamic law and in the Quran, women are allotted half the inheritance of their male counterparts. So if a son is going to get X amount, the daughter gets half the amount that the son gets. In Islamic court, a woman's testimony is worth half that of a man's testimony. This is extremely problematic when it comes to sexual violations against women. If a woman is raped and she wants to go to court to have the rapist brought to justice, Islamic law requires that there be four witnesses to the rape. How often does that happen? And if the woman goes without doesn't have any witnesses, but goes just upon the basis of her word and accuses the man that indeed raped her, the court will bring the man in and say, "You've been accused of rape. Did you rape this woman?" Well, the man, all he has to do is say no. His testimony trumps her testimony because it's worth twice as much as a woman's testimony. So he gets off scot-free. But then the court says to the woman, "You've just acknowledged that you've had illicit sexual relations. You said you were raped. We don't find any rapists, but nonetheless, your claim is that you had sexual relations. So you are guilty of having sex outside of the marriage relationship, and so you are liable to the punishment of Sharia law. Now, with adultery, the punishment for adultery is death. Fornication with someone who's not yet married is, I believe, it's 100 lashes. But in any case, because of this inequity in the legal system, women are put in legal jeopardy on a daily basis throughout the Muslim world. A Muslim man, according to the Quran, can have up to 4 wives at any time and can divorce any of those wives for the slightest of reasons and then marry her in their place. A Muslim man can also marry Jewish or Christian women, that is, women who are not Muslims but are from a monotheistic tradition. But a Muslim woman can only have one husband, and her husband cannot be anything other than a Muslim. Muslim wives must please their husbands sexually whenever the man desires pleasure. The Quran has this interesting passage: "Your wives are as a tilth unto you." Do you know what a tilth is? Oftentimes those in agrarian areas know it. Tilth is an old phrase for land that is arable, that can be plowed and planted. So the bronze image of a woman is as a plot that is to be plowed, and the man is the plow. And so this passage says you can go into your wives whenever you wish, because your wife is like a field to be seeded. Islamic tradition, again the hadith, have Muhammad teaching that if a woman refuses the call of the husband to please him sexually, unless she is ill or there's some super extenuating circumstance, if she refuses, that Muhammad taught the angels will curse her until the morning time. Muslim men are also free to have sex at their leisure with any female slaves that they own. The Quran declares, men, those Muslims who abstain from sex except with those that are joined to them in marriage, okay, you understand that, or the captives whom their wife has possessed, that is, those either whom they have won in battle, as they've killed the husband, and so they've taken wife, their wives and children as booty for themselves. For in their case, Muhammad said, or Allah said, they are free from blame. So sexual slaves are permitted in Islam for men to own and to have the female slaves as their own sex slaves. Husbands may resort to physical violence against their wives. They fear insubordination from them. We already looked at that passage. Just a reminder. Women are required to guard their private parts, so never let a man see or touch them other than their husbands. This command is the reason behind stipulations that women of marriageable age are not to leave the home without the permission of their primary male guardian, and always in the company of an approved male escort, a family member, someone related by blood, so that that man could never marry that woman legally in Islam because of their closeness of blood relationship. And they are to be clothed with modesty. Here's where the teachings on hijab and the burqa or abaya, depending on the part of the Arab or Muslim world you're from, find their warrant. This is also the justification behind the honor killings. Have you all heard of that term, honor killings? The woman is required to guard her chastity. If for some reason she doesn't, that can mean she falls in love with a man that's not approved by the family, and they don't often get married together. The family hasn't approved that. She is seen as not being legally married, and as a result of joining herself to this other man that the family doesn't approve of, she has brought shame and moral stain upon the family, upon the name of the father and the brothers. As a result, Muslim culture, not Islamic law, but Muslim culture says that the family has the right to cleanse their honor by the death of the woman or girl who has brought shame upon the family. And so the term honor kills. Interestingly, female sexuality in Islam must be controlled because women are by nature temptresses and men are too weak to withstand such temptation. It's a fascinating perspective that the men are the ones who are in charge, but when it comes to feminine sexuality, the men just fold like cheap tents. You know, they can't help themselves. So it all falls upon the woman to make sure that she does not get taken advantage of by anyone. And of course, what that means is if a man rapes a woman, he can claim that it wasn't his fault because the woman was tempting him. She was dressed inappropriately. She showed a little too much of her neckline. Her dress was about her ankles, something, and the temptation was just so overwhelming the man couldn't control himself. It was the woman's fault. And so we find in the Muslim world this reality of female genital mutilation, FGM, fault, where culturally, it actually is also supported by in Sharia law, that not only are men to be circumcised, but women are to be circumcised. That is, their clitoral area is to be excised. The reason for that is that the men think, or Islam teaches, that the women would otherwise be so wildly out of control sexually that they would disrupt society. That if their genitals are excised, or part of them are excised, that will lower their sexual energy and then they'll be able to maintain their virginity. We also find the rising, alarmingly rising percentages of sexual attacks in European countries now by Muslim migrants. It's justified within Islam by this understanding that non-Muslim women are fair game for Muslim men. If they're not Muslim, if the women aren't Muslim, then they have no rights, and the Muslim men are given the ability, if they're able, to take advantage of non-Muslim women. According to this one hadith tradition in Bukhari, which is the best known and most widely accepted of all the hadith traditions, women are inferior to men in three ways, Muhammad said. First, they curse and are ungrateful to their husbands. Second, they are defective in intelligence compared to men. And third, they are defective in the practice of Islamic rituals. Why is this the case? The story actually goes like this. Muhammad is passing by a bunch of women, and he says to them, you need to take extra care, pray more, and spend more time studying the Quran and so on. Because, he said, I've seen into the gates of hell, and the majority of the inhabitants of hell are women. The women say to him, why, O Prophet? Is that the case? Muhammad's response is because you are defective compared to men in these three ways. When he says to them you're defective in intelligence, they say to him, how are we defective in intelligence? And Muhammad says, isn't that the case that a woman's testimony in a court of law is worth half that of a man's? They say, well, yes. He said, that's how you're defective in intelligence. What Muhammad meant by that is that women are these emotional beings who often don't see reality objectively. They're so overwhelmed by their emotions. And that's why you can't depend upon one woman's testimony of an event that takes place, because she's probably very biased. But if you have two women, the other woman will see it from a different angle, and maybe you can get at the truth from these two competing testimonies of these women who are so full of progesterone or whatever it is that's causing them not to see reality so straight. But if a man comes in, well, the man is going to see things objectively, and his testimony is reliable. So Muhammad says that women's intelligence is not you can't depend upon them. That's why they're inferior, defective in intelligence. Secondly, he says you're defective in how you practice the religion or your ability to practice the religion. They say, how are we inferior to men? And he says that isn't it not the case that at the time of your menses, your menstrual cycle, that you are not permitted to pray? They say yes. Nor are you allowed to fast? They say yes. He says that's how you're defective in your religion as well. So, as a result, he said, the majority of the population of hell will be women. He also thought that there are three things that negate the prayers of a Muslim if they pass in front of one of the Muslim who's praying: a dog, a donkey, and a woman. In fact, when Muhammad gave that teaching, his youngest wife, Aisha, when he married when she was 6 years old, consummated the relationship when she was 9, she said to Muhammad, as a result of this teaching, you have made us like dogs. You made women like dogs. Muhammad just shrugged his shoulders, didn't say anything. But the teaching stood. Muslim men are permitted to marry prepubescent girls, according to the Quran. This is Surah 65, verses 1 and 4 says, O Prophet, this is Allah speaking, when ye do divorce women, divorce them at their prescribed periods and count actively their prescribed periods. The idea here is, if a man wants to divorce his wife, she's still childbearing age, he can declare her divorce. All he has to do is say, I divorce you 3 times, and the divorce is final, except they have to wait for 3 months, 3 courses of menstruation to make sure that the woman has not gotten pregnant, was not pregnant at the time the man divorced her. So they give 3 months for that. And the Quran goes on to say, such of your women as have passed the age of monthly courses, that is, we are close to menopausal now, for them the prescribed period, if you have any doubts, is still 3 months. And for those who have no courses, it is the same. That is, those who have not yet begun to have periods, prepubescent. For those who carry life within their wombs, the pregnant, you want to divorce them, their period is until they deliver their burdens. And for those who fear God, He will make their path easy. Nevertheless, Muslim women, and with all of this being true about Muslim understanding of women, Muslim women fare better in Islamic society than two other accepted classes of people: the Jinni, who are protected non-Muslims living within Muslim culture, and slaves, particularly dark-skinned ones, and we'll get to what that means. The Jinni, it's an Arabic word that means literally protected one. They're a class of people created by Muhammad who are allowed to live under the Muslim caliphate, the one ruler of the Islamic world, without converting to Islam or becoming full slaves. But they must first meet the condition of being monotheists, Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, and so on. They must pay an annual poll tax to the caliphate, up to 50% of their earnings. They must willingly endure humiliation, live in subjugation, with truncated legs compared to the Muslims around them. The Quran says, this is a famous passage, "Fight against those who, one, believe not in Allah, two, nor in the last day, three, nor forbid that which has been forbidden by Allah and His Messenger, and four, those who acknowledge not the religion of truth, that is Islam, among the people of the scripture, the Jews and Christians." So fight against those people until they pay the jizya, which is this poll tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued or subjugated. They have to be humiliated, not just pay this amount. The Pact of Omar is a document that is revered within the Islamic world, giving a picture of how Muslims are supposed to treat the dhimmi. So for Jews and Christians, no new construction of churches or synagogues, nor the repair of ones that have fallen into ruins. You must offer board and lodging for up to 3 days for any Muslim passerby who wants to come and take advantage of your hospitality. There can be no public display of the religion of the dhimmis, nor attempts to convert others, but those of the dhimmis who want to convert to Islam must be allowed to convert. You must show respect for Muslims, rising or giving up your seat, dismounting from steeds. Non-Muslims are not allowed to own horses because horses were steeds of war. They could have donkeys because nobody feared much when someone was riding towards them on a donkey. But still, if you're on a donkey, you're higher off the ground than the Muslim that is going to pass by you. You have to dismount so that you're not higher than the Muslim. You speak only when spoken to by a Muslim, never raise a hand in anger against the Muslim. You must not dress like Muslims, as you have to show yourself as being apart from the Muslim community, wearing an identifying mark. It's not all that surprising that you see this same trend taking place within the Nazi party and the Third Reich, where Jews particularly were made to wear this, yellow Star of David as a distinguishing mark. Must not teach the Quran to the non-Muslims, must allow Muslims entry into churches day or night, so we can inspect to make sure the churches aren't planning some kind of rebellion or sedition. May not bear arms or sell alcohol, must shave our forelocks, cut part of the hair is a sign of humiliation. Pay the jizya, as I mentioned. Promise not to harbor any enemies of the caliphate, to turn them in immediately, not display the cross publicly on our buildings or persons, not worship in ways that draw public attention, like the ringing of bells, chanting, and singing. ISIS, of course, has picked up this. We've seen so many pictures in Iraq and Syria of ISIS fighters destroying churches, or at least selling off crosses from the tops of steeples and domes. Same idea again. So that's the dhimmi. Second class, actually third class citizens. You have Muslim men, Muslim women, and then the dhimmi. And then the next group are slaves. So of course in Islam, all human beings are the slaves of Allah. But those who become Muslims are permitted to own non-Muslims as slaves. Most people don't know this, but Islam has been the greatest enslaver of human beings in all of history. It's estimated that in Africa alone, over the course of the 1,000-plus years that Muslims have been in ascendancy in Africa, that Muslim African slave traders sold some 11 million Africans, non-Muslims for the most part, to the Atlantic slave trade business. Black slave traders, the ones who captured and made people into slaves, would take them to the slave market and then sell them to the Atlantic, the European white slave traders, who would load them on slave ships and then bring them over to the New World. It's estimated some 11 million was brought over to the New World. But interestingly, of that 11 million, about 380,000 ended up in the original colonies. The vast majority were ended up in the Caribbean, Central, and South America. some 13 million slaves additionally were sent to the Middle East and Asia, that is to the Muslim world, principally the Muslim world, and they were sold to Muslims to be their slaves. These are mostly dark-skinned African peoples. It's also estimated that for every slave that was sold on the market, some 5 to 10 others died in the process, either as slaves, as those who were captured to be slaves and who died on the way to the market in forced marches, or people who, mostly the slaves, were able-bodied youngish men, and often those individuals were the ones who were caretakers for the elderly or for little children within their tribes, wherever they were in Africa. If the able-bodied man was taken out of the equation, the elderly who couldn't fend for themselves and little children who couldn't fend for themselves were left to the forces of nature and would often die. So conservatively, the Muslim slave trade, over 1,000-plus years of it, of Islamic rule in the African world, led to the deaths of somewhere close to 125 or more million people in order to produce 25 million slaves that were sold. Muhammad, who in Islam is considered the perfect role model for life, promoted slavery. He killed infidel men so as to enslave their women and children. He gifted slaves to others as a gesture of affection or reward or goodwill. And he received slaves as gifts from other rulers. He owned many slaves. He used some as sex slaves. He gave some to his men for their pleasure. He created the rules that approved the rape of captured women. And he sold slaves in the marketplace in order to raise funds to continue the work of jihad. You sell a slave, you use the proceeds to buy horses, to buy weapons, to buy camels, so that you can advance your military agenda. In contrast to that, around the same time that Muhammad lived, Muhammad was born 570 AD, died 632, we have this Orthodox Christian, St. Isidore of Seville, born 560, 10 years before Muhammad, died 636, 4 years after Muhammad's death. He said, God has made no difference between the soul of the slave and that of the freedman. As a result, human beings should have the same dignity. Still today, Islam does not reject slavery as inherently wrong, but many Muslim countries, in order to join the civilized world of the United Nations, were forced to reject or abjure slavery officially as part of their legal system in order to gain membership into the UN. Saudi Arabia finally did this in 1962, Yemen and Oman in 1970, Niger in 2004. Mauritania has declared that slavery is illegal, but Mauritania openly practices slavery. We still see this in many Muslim lands and Muslim governments. Turn a blind eye to it. Saudi Arabia, Sudan, the Gulf states, wouldn't be called slavery now, would be called indentured servitude, where a person is taken to work for a family or for an individual. Their passport is taken, they can't leave. They're promised that they'll be paid, but they're paid at the leisure of the one who has supposedly hired them, who basically owns them. And we see racism linked together with slavery. In the Arabic-speaking world, the term abid is a plural word for slaves. Abd, you hear the word abd, abdullah, means slave of Allah. Abd is the word for slave, abid, the word for slave. Oftentimes, if you know Arabic, and you hear Muslims, Arabs talking to each other, as black skinned individuals pass them, they will refer to the black skinned individuals as Abi. It's become a popular term for a black person. It usually meant slave. In the Muslim mind, dark skin still is linked to being a slave. Lighter skin means you're a better person, darker skin means you deserve to be enslaved. And we see that in the language that is still used commonly in the Arab world. Next, that chapter, or Kukar or Kapirun. Those are all words. The Kapir is singular, Kukar and Kapirun are plural of the same word. These are the unbelievers who live outside of the Muslim world in what Islam refers to as Dar al-Harb. Dar al-Harb means the house of war. If you're not in Islam, we'll talk about this more in the next lecture. If you're not within the world of Islam, you're on the outside, you're considered to be in the abode of war. Islam is at war with you. The kuffar are the unbelievers who live outside of the world of Islam. They have no recognized rights unless and until they submit to Islam. Until then, they're fair game for the Muslim world to do with them as they please if they're able. The term kafir is used within Muslim culture much like the N-word is used among white supremacists. It's a term of extreme disrespect you and I, according to Islamic teaching, well not me, I'm an apostate, you are kafir, and as such you're regarded as one who has rebelled against Allah. Jihad is to be waged against you, that is warfare, until you either become a Muslim, or are killed in battle, or you surrender and become a dhimmi, or you're captured in the midst of warfare, and then you become a slave. The next group are the apostates in this time. Apostates are those who, once having been publicly received into Islam, they've taken the shahada, that is the oath, the one creedal statement of Islam, there is no God but Allah, Muhammad is his prophet. If you repeat that, intending to show that you believe that, you now have become a Muslim. If after that you decide that you no longer wish to be a Muslim, you're in bad luck. An apostate, one who declares that he no longer wants to be a Muslim, is to be given the opportunity to recant, to return to Islam, but if he or she refuses, that person is then to be executed. There is no inalienable right to freedom of religion in Islam. Conversion is all one way. Sort of the religious version of the Welcome to the Hotel California. Remember that? You ask for the right man, the program to receive. You can check out any time you want, but you can never leave. So in summary, human beings according to Islam are not made in the image of God, and so have no inherent rights. They're slaves of Allah, subject to his whims and decrees. Allah gives preference to believers over unbelievers, to men over women, to the free over slaves, to the dhimmi over resistors. And because of this lack of equal treatment before Allah, Muslim countries have refused to sign the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because no human beings have inherent rights. So, lastly, Islam's ultimate agenda is to subdue the human race, ascribing dignity and value to those who surrender to Allah, but using and abusing the rest of humanity in order to advance their supremacist ideology that Allah prefers Muslims to non-Muslims. And this, according to Allah, is good and right and is a foretaste of heaven and the past. So,
you did an excellent job. I want you to see a picture, folks. And you have been drinking from a real firehouse, as he has presented to you a picture of our human rights. And I hope now you understand why in our advertising I said, why are the Muslims getting a pass? So Vicky, you're a woman. After the break, you're going to come on and explain to us why a woman would ever convert. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and then I'm going to introduce you to Brian.